From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama backs Japan over its territorial dispute with China as the US leader's Asia visit gets underway.
He's not trying to provoke China in this context, but he's trying to set out a position that probably gives the United States some running room.
Also today, Denver's doctor shortage looks set to spread across the nation. Our Colorado correspondent has that story. And the US Supreme Court hears a case that could impact military families poisoned by toxic drinking water in North Carolina.
Absolutely a slap in the face to the men and women who served there, more than a million Marines and their families and civilians who bathed and drank in poisoned water for more than 30 years.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia will respond if its interests in Ukraine are attacked. In an interview to the TV channel Russia Today, he insisted that an attack on a Russian citizen would equal an attack on the Russian Federation. Anya Ardayeva reports from Moscow.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the United States cannot run the show in each and every part of the world, adding that Washington's ready-made solution would not fix a crisis it does not understand. He also said if interests of Russians have been attacked directly, like the war in South Ossetia, for example, I do not see any other way but to respond in accordance with international law. A government in Kiev has expressed concerns that Russia is planning a military invasion to eastern Ukraine, while Russia has been amassing thousands of troops at the border. The Kremlin insists its troop movements are within the bounds of international law.
And the U.S. State Department is urging the Russian government to free an American journalist who is being held by pro-Russian separatists in the east of Ukraine. Simon Ostrovsky was detained earlier this week along with five other reporters. U.S. President Barack Obama has begun his four-nation Asia trip with a strong statement of support for Japan over islands that are at the center of a territorial dispute with China. In an interview with a Japanese newspaper, Mr. Obama affirmed that the islands are covered by America's bilateral defense treaty with Tokyo. It's the first time Washington has given such explicit support on the issue, as Lorna Shattuck reports from the U.S. Capitol.
Mr. Obama arrived in Japan on Wednesday for a trip meant to show that the U.S. is committed to its partners in the region, even as China becomes more assertive. The recent annexation of the Crimea by Russia has sparked concern in the region about the extent of U.S. political will to protect Asian allies. This latest statement over the Senkaku Islands, called the Diaoyu Islands by China, seems aimed at reassuring Tokyo that the U.S. would come to its defense if Beijing were to attempt to seize the territory.
Rival Palestinian groups Hamas and Fatah say they're aiming to reconcile and form an interim unity government within the next few weeks. The joint announcement was made by Fatah's Azam al-Ahmed, the envoy of internationally recognized Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, and the prime minister of the Hamas group, Ismail Haniyeh. They said general elections may be held as early as December. This is not the first time the groups have attempted to reconcile, and the announcement is likely to complicate ongoing troubled talks between Palestine and Israel. The U.S., EU, and Israel say Hamas is a terrorist organization. Israel's already pulled out of a negotiation meeting in response, and previously, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said President Mahmoud Abbas could either find peace with Hamas or with the Israelis, but not with both. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The head of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, says Sao Paulo's delayed stadium will only be ready for this year's World Cup at the last minute. Two fatal accidents and a host of other delays have raised questions over Brazil's readiness to host the tournament, which kicks off on June 12th. The U.S. government says it's appalled and horrified by the killings in South Sudan, which were apparently motivated by ethnic differences. The UN estimates hundreds of people seeking sanctuary were gunned down by rebels, and ongoing violence has forced 1 million to flee their homes. Here's Priscilla Huff from Washington.
The Obama administration is putting South Sudan's President Salva Kiir on notice. The cycle of violence must end. The White House blames hate speech broadcast on radio and says the victims were apparently targeted for their ethnicity, condemning the violence in the strongest of terms. The statement from the American president called it an abomination, appalling and horrifying.
and a Twitter outreach campaign by the New York City Police Department has backfired after users responded by posting negative images of police officers. That response went viral, quickly becoming a trending topic on the social media network. Iris Spitzer has more from New York.
It began innocently enough. The police department posted a picture of two friendly-looking officers posing with a civilian, then asked users to tweet similar photos and add the hashtag MyNYPD. However, people quickly began responding with images of police brutality and misconduct using the department's own hashtag. New York police have long had an uneasy relationship with some communities, made worse in recent years by their use of the controversial stop-and-frisk policing technique. The NYPD seemed to take it in stride, though. After the campaign went viral, the police department issued a response saying that the uncensored exchange and open dialogue were good for the city.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. President Barack Obama has opened his tour of Asia by throwing U.S. support behind Japan over a territorial dispute with China. The long-running row centers on the sovereignty of a group of uninhabited islands in the East China Sea. In an interview with a Japanese newspaper, Mr. Obama said the islands fall under America's bilateral defense treaty with Tokyo. For more on Washington's show of support for Japan, I spoke to Jonathan Pollock, Asia expert with the Brookings Institute.
The technicality here is that the United States insists that with respect to the disputes between China and Japan, both of whom claim sovereignty over these islands, that the United States does not, on the one hand, does not take a position on the dispute over sovereignty, but it does recognize that Japan has administrative control over the islands, even though there are no personnel located on the islands. So by that, on that basis, President Obama, in this interview he gave, asserted that this would fall within what are called the Article 5 provisions of the U.S.-Japan Mutual Security Treaty. He didn't specify anything about what the U.S. would or would not do, and it's easy to kind of misconstrue his remarks when he's trying to, you know, walk something of a fine line between, on the one hand, supporting Japan or stating support for Japan, but on the other hand, not giving Japan anything that anyone would regard as a blank check with respect to their conduct over the islands.
As you've said, we don't have the detail, the firm facts on exactly what this show of support for Japan means. But clearly, President Obama has put the United States in Japan's corner. What could, theoretically, what could this mean in terms of U.S. support for that region?
Well, you know, I mean, President Obama is very careful with his words. He's very, very disciplined in what he does and does not say. On the one hand, he has affirmed the Article 5 commitment under the treaty, and he could argue very, very logically that, you know, given that this is, you know, territory that Japan controls, that would not be inappropriate. He's not trying to provoke China in this context, but he's trying to set out a position that probably gives the United States some running room, more to the point, might provide the basis for a more candid private discussion with Prime Minister Abe now that the president is in Japan, because the United States has no desire whatsoever, no interest in seeing the situation basically over, you know, a small group of inconsequential islands, rocks, basically, where the only residents are goats. So, granted, often in international politics, locations or pieces of territory of utterly no consequence assume larger strategic meaning. He's trying to find a way to dial that down, if he can, rather than give the kinds of signals that in any sense might lead to escalatory tendencies.
And Jonathan, how much will that turmoil and unrest in Ukraine bleed into Obama's visit to Asia as he attempts this rebalancing, re-energizing of relations and ties in that region?
It's not front and center of the policy calculations of anyone in East Asia. On the other hand, I think that there is some concern expressed, particularly within East Asia, is that will the United States and the Obama administration find itself so consumed and distracted by events in Ukraine that it does not pay sufficient heed to the developments in East Asia. And here again, I think what we can say, as in the instance of events that came in the aftermath of Arab Spring, including the Syrian civil war, is that the urgent tends to drive out the important. If you're asking what does a senior leader spend most of his time thinking about and worrying about. So, but I think the president's presence on this trip, the fact that he decided to reschedule a visit to Southeast Asia that was originally scheduled for last fall and then had to be canceled, the fact that he will travel again to Asia in November should be evidence to anyone, if they bother to look carefully, that the U.S. is a global power, and it has to find a way for how you balance your attention across these issues and across these domains, avoiding the easy trap of presuming that you can, in effect, walk away from some concerns and just concentrate on others.
Jonathan Pollock, Asia expert with the Brookings Institute. This is FSN Reports. The US Supreme Court heard a case today from a group of North Carolina residents whose well water was contaminated by the electronics manufacturer CTS. They say the state law that sets a 10-year time limit on suing a corporation is unconstitutional because cancers and other harms from industrial waste may take decades to appear. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein was in the courtroom and says the outcome of this case will impact an even bigger contamination lawsuit in which US Marines and their children are suing the government itself for exposing them to toxic chemicals on a military base.
Retired Master Sergeant Jerry Ensminger served for more than 24 years in the U.S. Marines, 11 of those years at the Camp Lejeune military base in North Carolina. In 1985, his six-year-old daughter Janie died from leukemia. Along with dozens of others exposed to contaminated water on the base, he's been trying since then to hold the U.S. government accountable. Today, the Supreme Court heard a case that could bar victims in North Carolina like Ensminger from having their day in court because they sued more than 10 years after the contamination occurred.
Basically, what they're saying is if you're deceptive enough and devious enough and crooked enough to keep all the information about your negligence quiet and you make it over that 10-year finish line, you're going to get rewarded. Really? That's what you call justice?
Ensminger's wrongful death lawsuit, along with cases brought by many of his fellow Camp Lejeune Marines afflicted with rare diseases like male breast cancer, could be thrown out forever if the Supreme Court sides with the electronics corporation CTS, who argued today that the federal government shouldn't mess with North Carolina's 10-year time limit on such lawsuits. Many other corporations who've been accused of toxic contamination, including the members of the American Petroleum Institute and the American Chemistry Council, are backing them in this case. But so is the U.S. government.
I feel betrayed. Stab you in the back. I mean, is this how they thank us for our service? By poisoning our families and then using legal gymnastics to get out of their neglect? No, I'm sorry. This is criminal.
At issue before the court is whether Congress's federal laws for toxic waste cleanup and accountability can trump state laws like North Carolina's that greatly limit the ability of impacted communities to bring lawsuits. The lawyer for CTS Corporation, Brian Murray, said the court would be in dangerous constitutional territory and raise serious federalism problems if they overruled the state's law. But Angela Canterbury, with the Project on Government Oversight, says there's no way Congress intended victims of toxic pollution to be unable to sue after just 10 years.
If they made public the water contamination in 1985, they were supposed to then have filed by 95, is just ludicrous because many Marines hadn't even been notified. many of them, and much less been ill.
Even if the court rules against the corporation, the residents won't necessarily get compensated for the damage to their health and homes. It would only allow them to file a lawsuit and argue their case. Tate McQueen, a teacher and coach from Asheville, North Carolina, is about one of two dozen homeowners who would be impacted.
We've had 50 people diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma cancer within a mile of the site. We have scores of pancreatic and liver cancer along with kidney cancer. We've had esophageal cancer, sinus cancer, suppressed immune systems. You name it, we're getting it.
During the arguments, several justices expressed concern that upholding the North Carolina law would incite other states to pass similar measures, triggering what they called a race to the bottom. Canterbury said if this comes to pass, lawmakers would need to intervene.
If the court allows that to be enforced, in this case in Asheville and in others like in Camp Lejeune, then it means that Congress is going to have to act and make clear their intention to not cut off justice by some arbitrary timeline.
The Supreme Court is expected to rule on the case this summer. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, a new study in the U.S. state of Colorado shows there are not enough doctors to serve the population. It's an issue that has long affected many rural communities in America, but that is now also becoming a problem in some urban areas. Our correspondent, Mary McCarthy, reports.
Allison, can you tell me what brought you in today?
Well, kind of an ER follow-up.
Dr. Ozzy Granardo's private practice in the Denver suburb of Parker keeps him very busy.
Are you staying well hydrated?
Yes.
But several times a month, he also travels to small towns in Colorado that don't have a resident physician.
Rocky Ford, Ordway, and La Junta, Colorado, so smaller towns, the demand that's there is outstanding. It's remarkable to see how many people actually need care.
And it's not just rural areas in Colorado that don't have enough doctors. Several densely populated counties are also affected.
We see it every day. The urban clinics and even some of the suburban clinics really have a lack of providers, whether or not it's PCPs or then the specialists to help.
Rebecca Alderfer of the Colorado Health Institute authored the recent study on the doctor shortage. She attributes the problem in part to the fact that the state doesn't have many doctor training programs called residencies.
Physicians tend to practice close to where they either live or where they trained. So there's definitely interest right now at thinking through whether or not we have enough residency programs in areas where we want doctors to eventually locate in the future.
And in Colorado, like in many places across the U.S., the challenge is not just finding a doctor, but finding one who will take your specific health insurance. Physicians have the right to pick and choose which patients to see and which ones to refuse. Dr. Ozzy Granardo.
So there may be providers who are available to see someone in a community, either in a rural setting or an urban setting, but because they don't take that insurance, that then prevents them from having the access that they need. It's a struggle for a lot of people.
Many doctors say they just can't afford to see patients on Medicaid, the government-run health insurance program for low-income Americans.
In an ever-increasing competitive environment, it becomes a process of making sure that their patient base is one that can support the practice.
Recent data in Colorado shows that low-income residents have the worst access to doctors and often simply end up going to the hospital when their needs become urgent.
Last resort is to then go to the emergency room for primary care, which is what none of us want to see because we feel like that's more expensive care and less appropriate care for patients.
Meanwhile, some regions are simply learning to function with fewer doctors and to depend more on support staff. Rebecca Alderfer.
There's a lot of questions about whether or not team-based care that really relies more heavily on sort of the nurse practitioners and physician assistant models and even care navigators, whether or not that adds capacity to the system that then sort of frees up physicians and others to really focus on people that need sort of the acute care or have chronic ongoing conditions.
State and federal officials have been addressing the doctor shortage with a program that forgives what are often hefty medical school loans. For graduates who opt to work in regions where there just aren't enough physicians to go around. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
Now, around the world, the 450th anniversary of the birth of William Shakespeare is being celebrated today. Major festivities were held at his birthplace in the UK's Midlands area, in the quaint town of Stratford-upon-Avon. Our UK correspondent Natalie Feary travelled to the playwright's hometown and has this report.
All you have to do is come to the house where Shakespeare was born and grew up to see how popular he still is, 450 years after his birth. Last year, over 800,000 visitors came through the doors here, a record-breaking number. With people coming from all over the world, his status as a global icon is clear. Among the visitors to the house was Australian tourist Fallon.
It's absolutely amazing and also very surreal to be here and to experience, you know, where he was born and, you know, where the icon began.
But some say the classical and biblical references, as well as the complex language, make Shakespeare's plays difficult for a modern audience to understand.
What's more, or close the wall up with our English dead?
Though others argue that the themes Shakespeare's plays explore are just as relevant now as when he wrote them. A view held by Richard Byrne, a dramatic presenter at the Shakespeare Centre.
The way he presents human nature, everyone can relate to that. You know, he wrote about love. We can all still relate to love. You know, we wrote about jealousy. We can all still relate to jealousy.
And interest in his plays has grown significantly in the last 20 years, says Scott Lewis, a period interpreter also at the Shakespeare Centre.
It's been made more popular with films and big superstars such as Leonardo DiCaprio starring in such films as Romeo and Juliet. And I also think that the education in schools has changed.
Here at Stratford-upon-Avon, a whole array of celebrations are taking place to commemorate 450 years since he was born here, on the 23rd of April. At the weekend, thousands of people, including dignitaries and actors, will line the streets for a procession from his birthplace to the Holy Trinity Church where he was buried. Bringing the great man's plays to life for children and young people is also one of the major aims, as the 450th anniversary of his birth is marked, to encourage them to take an interest in Shakespeare's works. And the popularity of Britain's most famous playwright is expected to continue to grow. The celebrations this week are expected to be modest compared to those set to take place in 2 years' time. Then, the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death will be commemorated. There will be a plethora of documentaries, exhibitions and special productions. And even more visitors are expected to flock here. Natalie Feary, Stratford-upon-Avon.
Finally today, FSN Spotlight, a new segment on the programme that brings you in-depth analysis of an issue or a subject that you might not otherwise have noticed. Today, the future of the United States Constitution, as viewed by a man who dedicated much of his life to protecting it. Justice John Paul Stevens spent 35 years on the Supreme Court, starting with his appointment by Republican President Gerald Ford until his retirement just 4 years ago. Although appointed by a Republican, his views evolved over time and he became known as one of the court's most outspoken liberal voices. His new book is called Six Amendments: How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. He sat with PBS NewsHour anchor Judy Woodruff, and she started by asking him whether his proposals are practical.
Well, it certainly would take time to do that job completely, but there's no reason why one or two amendments might be adopted before the others, and I think the issues in each of the ones I discuss are sufficiently important that it's worth spending time debating them and thinking about it.
You single out rules, Justice Stevens, that were handed down, as you point out, by a slim majority of the court over the last 40 years that you say, and I'm quoting you now, have had such a profound and unfortunate impact on our basic law that resort to the process of amendment is warranted. You're essentially taking on the modern Supreme Court.
Well, of course, I've been trying to do that for a good many years. But I think there were incorrect decisions that were profoundly unwise and really contrary to a lot of things that our country stands for, and I think they should be changed.
You also want to amend the Constitution to abolish the death penalty. People who've always opposed the death penalty lament how long they say it took you to change your mind from the time you came on the court in 1975 until 2008.
Well, I think that what's happened in the period that I've been on the court is that the court has used death penalty litigation to develop rules that make conviction more likely than it should be. And the rules governing the selection of the jury, for example, rules governing the admissibility of victim impact evidence at the penalty phase of a trial. Those rules have slanted the opportunity for justice in favor of the prosecutor. And I think it's particularly incorrect to do it in the capital context because the cost is so high. If you make a mistake in a capital case, there's no way to take care of it later on. And the risk of an incorrect execution in any case, to me, is really intolerable. And the system should not permit that possibility to exist.
You believe Congress should be able to put limits on the amount of money candidates spend on their campaigns.
Yes.
And that the Supreme Court has made mistakes in several decisions allowing corporations, labor unions, to advocate and spend money on candidates. Considering all the court has done, Justice Stevens, to open the door for huge money to pour into American politics, including the recent McCutcheon decision, what effect does all this have on American politics?
As the Chief Justice said, I think, in the first sentence of his opinion in the McCutcheon case the other day, there's nothing more important than participation in electing our representatives. But the law that developed in that case and in a number of other cases involved not electing the representatives of the people who voted for them, but electing representatives in other jurisdictions where the financing is used. In other words, that was a case that involved the right of an individual to spend as much of his money as he wanted to elect representatives of other people. He didn't use any of that money to elect his own representatives. And I think that's a distortion of the concept that we started with many, many years ago.
You would change the wording of the Second Amendment to the Constitution to say the right of people to bear arms, to own a gun, should apply only when serving in the militia. Is it your ultimate hope that there would be no right to own a gun for self-defense?
Well, it would be my ultimate hope that legislatures would decide the issues and not be hampered by constitutional restrictions, because clearly legislators are in a much better position than judges are to decide what should be permissible in different contexts. And the effect of the Second Amendment as it's now construed is to make federal judges the final arbiters of gun policy, which is quite wrong, I think, and quite contrary to what the framers intended when they drafted the Second Amendment, to protect states from the danger that a strong federal armed force would be able to deprive the states of their own militias.
Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens talking there to Judy Woodruff on the PBS NewsHour. You can read the transcript of the interview at the NewsHour's website at pbs.org. And the book itself is called Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. And that marks the end of Wednesday's edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Thursday, we look at the South Sudan massacre the White House described as an abomination. That's Thursday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.